There are many accounts in the Pali Canon of different kinds of people, different kinds of being, going to visit the Buddha and putting questions to him. Or they would go to him and make remarks that he would then use as a basis for teaching. There was one chap called Ugga, who was the Raja's chief minister, who came to visit the Exalted One. That's how the Pali Canon describes the Buddha. And he starts talking about a merchant called Migara Rohaniya. And he says this: "Lord, it's amazing, it's astonishing how rich, wealthy and opulent this Migara Rohaniya is." The Buddha replied, "Well, what does his treasure amount to, Ugga?" "Lord, of gold there is 100,000, and of silver, who can tell?" "But is that really treasure, Ugga?" "Not that I say it is not, but that treasure is subject to fire, to water, to be taken away by rajas, or robbers, or enemies, or one's heirs." Riches, treasures, human beings seem to spend an inordinate amount of time collecting them. We must do it for a reason. Of course we do. Riches bring power. With riches, you have choice. You have a certain amount of independence. Being rich is surely a good idea. I remember a quote that I think somebody said was Michael Caine, who said, "I've been rich and I've been poor, and being rich is better." I don't think many of us would argue, or would we? Why do we want to be rich? Well, yes, of course. Power, choice, a certain amount of independence. But isn't there always also a sense of desiring security? We amass treasure in order to secure ourselves in an uncertain world and in an uncertain future. That treasure, that money, is going to stand us in good stead. Or alternatively, perhaps it's out of a sense of esteem, of wanting to improve one's worth, either in terms of the world out there or in terms of the way we see ourselves. So it's to do with self-image. The difficulty that the Buddha alludes to here is that we cannot rely on worldly treasure for our security or to shore up our self-image. All conditioned things are subject to decay and death. In Argentina a few years ago, the government ran out of money. So they raided people's savings accounts and used that. Their treasure was subject to, not rajas in that case, but the government. Wherever we have an attachment to something, there is always the fear of loss that comes with it. If we make ourselves rich in order to secure ourselves, there is always the fear that we will lose our riches. So in terms of our security, there is still the fear of being in an uncertain world, because we could have our riches taken away from us. And if we identify with our treasures, then to have our treasures taken away would be a major blow to our identity. So it doesn't actually work. I heard of one billionaire who tried to thwart his own heirs to his fortune and his massive art collection by creating a mausoleum and putting all his art collection in the mausoleum. And when he died, he'd have the mausoleum sealed up. He would be inside, dead of course, with his art collection, and no one would be able to get it. Now please, I'm talking about reliance here, the emotional reliance and existential reliance on worldly treasures. Is there another way? The Buddha said to Uga that there were seven treasures that are not subject to fire or water, that can't be seized by rajas or robbers, enemies, or one's own heirs. Which seven? The treasure of conviction or faith, the treasure of discipline, the treasure of fear of shame, the treasure of fear of blame, the treasure of listening, the treasure of generosity, and the treasure of discernment. And what I like to do tonight is just go through these seven and see if I can prize out why indeed these are true treasures. What about conviction? What is the treasure of conviction? The Buddha said this: there is the case where a disciple of the noble ones has conviction, is convinced of the Buddha's awakening. Indeed, the blessed one is worthy and rightly self-awakened, consummate in knowledge and conduct, well gone, an expert with regard to the world, unexcelled as a trainer for those people fit to be tamed, the teacher of divine and human beings, awakened, blessed. This is called the treasure of conviction. To have conviction about something, to have faith in something, is to resolve upon something. To have faith or conviction in the Buddha's awakening is to have faith and conviction that there is a cessation to suffering and that there is a way to it. Having this is a treasure because it gives life meaning. It gives us a solid foundation on which to base our lives and gives us a purpose other than trying to secure our image or our security through the accumulation of worldly possessions and wealth. It therefore immediately starts to lessen clinging attachment to the material world. The Buddha's teaching gives us a guide to right living also. It means that we have a way of understanding why life is the way it is, and it also brings immense solace during the difficult times of life. There's another aspect to this too. What is awakening? What does it mean to be awake? To be awake means that you have realized that life is entirely indivisible, that there are no things to become attached to at all. If we do analyze it, then we find that everything that we find is dependent upon something else for its existence. So everything is interrelated. In a way, you can look at it as being one infinite system with many parts. Any change to any part will have an effect on the entire system. If the sun disappeared, life on Earth would cease. If we didn't have oxygen, our lungs wouldn't work, our heart couldn't work. It's all a fully, absolutely perfect integrated system. Why is this important? It's important because we learn that all actions that we perform will necessarily have an impact on the world around us and will rebound upon us. Is the Buddha's teaching a treasure? Indeed it is. Is the Buddha's awakening a treasure? Indeed it is. Of this treasure, could you say that fire or water or rajas or robbers or enemies or heirs could take that away from you? The second treasure is discipline. This is what the Buddha had to say on discipline. And what is the treasure of discipline? There is the case where a disciple of the Noble Ones abstains from taking life, abstains from stealing, abstains from illicit sexual conduct, abstains from lying, abstains from taking intoxicants that cause heedlessness. This is called the treasure of discipline. Is discipline a treasure? Some people seem to think that discipline is an awful chore, and it's something that they wish they could do without. But in every area of life, there are rules that govern behaviour. I need only mention the highway code as an example. If we didn't have the highway code, what kind of mess would there be? I know exactly what it would be. It would be like New Delhi. If you've ever been to New Delhi, they drive on the wrong side of the roads, up the wrong way, down dual carriageways. There are cows on the roundabouts eating bits of plastic. It's anarchy. Having rules helps to protect us and to protect the world about us. If we take on board that all our actions do have an impact on the world around us and rebound upon us, then it makes sense to live by an ethical code of conduct. What that gives us is incredible. We gain an immense self-confidence through knowing that our actions are blameless. There is a sense of freedom from guilt. You can look people in the eyes. You can have real relationships. You're not having to hide so much. Indeed, just living a disciplined life brings spiritual maturity. One actually feels that you're a foot taller as a consequence of living an ethical life. It's also a very solid foundation for practicing mindfulness and meditation. So is living a disciplined life a treasure? Indeed it is. And could fire or water or rajas or robbers or enemies or heirs take that treasure away from you? Leading on from discipline, we have fear of shame and fear of blame. I've decided to treat these two together. What is the treasure of the fear of shame or the fear of blame? There is a case where a disciple of the Noble Ones feels shame at the thought of, or fears to be blamed for, bodily misconduct, verbal misconduct, mental misconduct. This is called the treasure of fear of shame and blame. Fear of shame and blame are naturally occurring states in every human being. They arise in wholesome, beautiful states of mind. The Buddha called them the guardians of the world because they stop the world from falling into widespread immorality. In organising this talk, I came across a quote which said, "I left a legacy of shame. It is something I will live with for the rest of my life." It was a quote by a disgraced financier apologising to a US court hearing where he was sentenced to 150 years in prison for fraud. What went wrong? The absence of wholesome fear of blame or fear of shame. Fear of shame in regard to our own actions, or fear of blame of what other people would think about us. These two treasures, they're subtle. in all of us, we have a very small voice within which says, I wouldn't do that if I were you. We also have within us very loud voices going, I want, I want, I want. And it's very easy for the very loud voice to drown out the very small voice. Fear of shame and blame are eroded through breaking precepts, for living unrestrained lives. They are strengthened, and that voice becomes stronger and louder through practicing restraint, through practicing the precepts, and for deliberately developing beautiful states of mind. So are the treasures of fear and shame and blame, are they a treasure? Indeed they are. Could fire or water or rajas or robbers or enemies or one's own heirs take that treasure away? How are beautiful states of mind developed? The next treasure is listening. And the Buddha had quite a lot to say about listening. This is what he had to say. And what is the treasure of listening? There is the case where a disciple of the Noble Ones has heard much, has retained what he has heard, has stored what he has heard. Whatever teachings are admirable in the beginning, admirable in the middle, admirable in the end, that in their meaning and expression proclaim the holy life that is entirely complete and pure, these he has listened to often, retained, discussed, accumulated, examined with his mind, and well penetrated in terms of his views. This is called the treasure of listening. When you got the newsletter, a few weeks ago, which part of the newsletter did you go for immediately? The news items about the garden? Perhaps not. The diary dates? Maybe. The Dhamma talk at the back? Oh yes. Well, this is what I hear. It's certainly what I go for. Or, why do you come here on a Wednesday night? Or rather than why you come here on a Wednesday night, what do you leave with? Isn't it the case when we come across the Dhamma, the teaching, that we find that it brings with it a certain serenity, a calmness? Perhaps it brings enthusiasm, joy. Perhaps it even brings inspiration and helps to give clues as to the way forward in the practice. Is listening a treasure? Of course it is. But it's also an art. The art of listening to Dhamma, or reading Dhamma, is to listen in the same way that you might listen to the breeze through the trees on a lazy summer afternoon, or to ocean waves. There's nothing to figure out. You're not pushing with the concepts, you're not pulling the concepts. You're just letting it wash over you, wash into you, allowing it to be absorbed, full of faith, full of conviction that this is the way to the cessation of suffering. I always say to people that in any Dhamma talk, you might just remember one thing. And I wonder if tonight that's the one thing you remember. So is listening a treasure? Of course it is. And could fire, or water, or rajas, or robbers, or enemies, or one's own heirs take that treasure away from you? The treasure of generosity. And what is the treasure of generosity? There is the case of the disciple of the Noble Ones, his awareness cleansed of the stain of stinginess, living at home, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in being magnanimous, responsive to requests, delighting in the distribution of alms. This is called the treasure of generosity. Isn't it a paradox that the Buddha is saying, giving away one's own bounty, hard-earned bounty, is a treasure? What does generosity bring? It brings beautiful states of mind, faith, devotion, self-confidence. It also brings practical experience that our actions have results, that we are indeed heirs to our own actions. The Buddha always maintains that through behaving generously, not just with our money, but with our time and our effort, it is always rewarded. And on a tangent to that, generosity towards a centre such as this, helping to keep going monastic orders where people have given their lives over to walking the path to freedom. Helping a centre like this materially helps to preserve the teaching. As a consequence, the people who enter into full-time training, they go through the training that much quicker through the support, and as a consequence are able to guide people from their own experience of how to walk the path to freedom. And there is a perfect reciprocal arrangement. Is generosity a treasure? Of course it is. And could fire or water or rajas or robbers or enemies or your own heirs take that treasure away from you? The last is discernment, the treasure of discernment. And what is the treasure of discernment? There is the case where a disciple of the Noble Ones is discerning, endowed with discernment of the arising and passing away of things. Noble, penetrating, leading to the utter ending of distress. This is called the treasure of discernment. Why is seeing the arising and passing away of things a treasure? Because it removes attachment to the world permanently. Because in reality, there are no separate lasting things. You can only crave, you can only be greedy for, you can only hate things. And with the continued observation of the arising and passing away of phenomena, you find that you cannot find those things for which you felt such greed. Please don't think that I'm saying that there is nothing. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that life is an indivisible whole. It is only when we conceptualize that we create the world. And all this practice leads to, in the end, is just the recognition that that's what the mind does. It conceptualizes, divides, and it's only when you take what the mind does seriously that there's ever a problem. All states dissolve into emptiness. There are no problems. There's nothing wrong with life. You only think there's a problem with life. So is discernment a treasure? Of course it's a treasure. Could fire or water or rajas or robbers or enemies or your own heirs take that treasure away from you? If you collect and make much of these treasures, you will find that you will develop what in the Pali is called sobhanacitta, beautiful states of mind. A beautiful state of mind contains all the components that we've talked about: the treasure of faith or conviction, the treasure of discipline, the treasures of fear of shame and blame, the treasures of fear of shame and the treasure of the fear of blame, get it right. the treasure of listening, the treasure of generosity, the treasure of discernment. Wholesome states of mind, beautiful states of mind, do not include defilements, do not include attachment. At those times when you have a beautiful state of mind, there is no wishing for life to be different than it is. There's no fear. There is a feeling of safety even in the midst of uncertainty. There is joy. The mind is full of interest, spontaneous, there is mindfulness, and you're in the moment. And you find that life is full of surprises. And there are just these incredible, unexpected moments of beauty, serendipity, good fortune, although you actually know it's the results of your own karma. You see opportunities everywhere. Life is an adventure. There are treasures everywhere, within and without. The enlightened mind is like a child who's been given a present at Christmas. And he opens the present and he puts the expensive gift to one side and then starts playing with the box. Give an enlightened being a diamond in one hand and give him a kiwi fruit sliced in half in the other. And he'll look at the diamond and he'll say, how beautiful, how amazing. And he'll look at the kiwi fruit in his other hand, at the pattern, and he'll think, how amazing, how beautiful. He'll see that one is not worth more than the other. Thank you very much.